Right, good morning everyone. Thanks very much for joining our webinar. This is the sixth in the series of AOSG webinars that we're delighted to have done this year. I hope that you can all hear me clearly. We've got a microphone this end, so we've done our best to make sure that the audio is as good as possible. What we're going to do is I'll just go through some of the housekeeping for the meeting, and then I'm going to hand over to Amanda Lawrence, who is down in Melbourne. So for those of you I haven't met, I'm Ginny Barber. I'm the director of the AOASG, and these webinars are part of our attempt to sort of do some outreach on some interesting topics around open access. We'll be taking questions at the end. The idea is that this is an opportunity for you to interact with the speaker. But what we found works best generally is if you type your questions into the chat box, then I will read them out and talk with Amanda about them at the end. You're also welcome to tweet. And if you have any other questions about how the webinar is running, please also just put them in the group chat. We are recording this, and the recording will go on our website along with Amanda's slides. If you have any concerns with recording, obviously, you know, just please let me know, and just be aware that if you do have something that's read out, it might well appear on the recording. Please keep your microphones muted if you can. You should be muted when you come in, but if not, if you can keep an eye on that, that would be great. We like good audio, and feedback can be rather horrendous. We'll finish on the hour or before for certain, and during it we'll be tweeting during the with the hashtag AOSG webinar, so feel free to have some conversations there, and we will keep an eye on those as we go along. So I'm going to hand over to Amanda. I'm just delighted that she's agreed to talk to us from the Analysis and Policy Observatory down in Melbourne, a really interesting group that I think is doing some tremendous work about collating information in a space that isn't often discussed or well discussed within the open access movement. So very much looking forward to hearing what Amanda's got to say, and please do feel free to ask her questions afterwards and let us know if you've got anything you'd like to know more about. So I will mute myself, turn my video off, and hand over to Amanda.
Great, thanks Ginny. So I'll share my screen now.
That's great, we can see your slides, just need to have it on slide view, on the screen view now.
Okay, great. Sorry, suddenly I've lost the visibility of the screen. So hello everybody. Sorry, it's still not fit. Right, okay, great. As you can hear, I'm a little bit croaky. I've had, I don't know if it's the cold or a flu or something, but it's been a pretty nasty experience over the last week. But I'm hoping that my voice is good enough to get us through for the next hour. Please do ask questions as they arise. I'm going to talk a bit about APO towards the second half of this talk, and in the beginning it's a bit more, I guess, exploratory on trying to get a sort of context around a sense of what knowledge is and means these days for us, and try and sort of blow open the open access concept a bit. So this is, in some ways, this is an exploration of some theoretical ideas that I'm still really grappling with myself. There's so much going on in this space, and yet the conversations often do seem still really quite siloized. So I wanted to start with some general sort of talk about the idea of knowledge as a public good, and so really to try and step back from the debates around open access and open access to academic research, and really think about what it is that we're dealing with here, which is access to knowledge. And knowledge can come in many different forms. So the one of the key thinkers in this space is Yoho Benkler, and he uses terms such as open access commons and commons-based peer production to talk about the way in which knowledge circulates and its roles in society. And knowledge, open access commons can be not only knowledge but also can be physical things such as town squares or footpaths or roads or waterways and so on. And there's a traditional sort of idea that these are often tragically underutilized or actually overexploited. And these theories of, in some cases, that can certainly be the case. But there are certain products that and contexts where actually the use of those can, the more people use them, the more beneficial that can be. So if lots of people come to a town square, then that creates a vibrant culture. Or if lots of people are using roads in order to get to places because they've got jobs and families and so on, then that's a positive contribution to society. So knowledge is something that is absolutely fundamental in that sense, that the more we can access it, the more we use it, the more that then we are able to create new forms of knowledge, etc. And that it's quite well proven now that it forms the foundation of innovation markets and creativity. And so by turning knowledge into a proprietary product, we actually limit our ability to be innovative because we need knowledge in order to create knowledge. So this is the dilemma of the intellectual property laws and or the effect of intellectual property laws, which limit the capacity of many of us to actually access the knowledge products. So it's worth thinking that knowledge is knowledge and know-how, and we often, when we're thinking about knowledge, we're only thinking about it as the product of intellectual labour, but it's also the experience and the practices that we have that are absolutely crucial. So the idea of a knowledge commons refers to the institutionalised community governance of the sharing and in some cases creation of information, science, knowledge, data and other types of intellectual and cultural resources. So we're really talking about a very expansive set of knowledge products, and underneath that there might be specific kinds, such as the research community's interest in formalised knowledge and research. And in some ways that forms a really important subset of a knowledge commons in terms of the research commons. So the what we're all reasonably familiar with is the traditional publishing products of academic research, trade and academic book publishing and academic journals. And this is often seen as being the key source of knowledge for the community. It's the channeled knowledge that is peer-reviewed, that is has the imprimatur of the university system, and it's absolutely massive. 2.5 million articles published every year now. This is a little bit dated, this slide, so I'm sure Virginia would be able to update me on just how many peer-reviewed journals are out now. So this is often what's referred to when we're talking about open access, and open access is often defined quite specifically in terms of peer-reviewed and published research papers. So the definition from the UK recently was unrestricted online access to peer-reviewed and published research papers. It's been a really long-standing attempt to wrestle the research knowledge commons from proprietary capture, by Big Publishing, which really launched in a big way from the 1950s when there was an explosion in research commissioning, a lot of it in the US and then around the world. And over that time, a rapid growth in large commercial publishing. Okay, so yes, we there's been an attempt for the last sort of 17 years to make journals more accessible, and in some ways this seems both to not have succeeded as well as possible. I think, Ginny, the last thing I heard from you was that the 30% figure is still pretty much where we've got to, but in other ways it's a testament to the interest and the importance placed on access to knowledge that even a 30% amount has been achieved. So we're all pretty familiar with green versus gold, and I'm not really going to go into it in too much detail. But in many ways, it shouldn't be surprising to think that big publishers that are making an absolute fortune are going to resist at every step of the way any attempt to reduce their ability to basically add a whole layer of exclusivity to goods that are fundamentally shouldn't be excluded, and that we are all losing the benefits of those things. So I think often it's seen as just how difficult this fight is going to be, I think, is continually underestimated. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be continually trying to push on it. And I think I would argue that the open access movement needs to expand and join forces with some of the other movements that are concerned about access to knowledge, and therefore being able to provide alliances that may strengthen this case. I think it's worth looking at where success has come from, where it's come from through institutional repositories, through discipline repositories such as Archive, and the large-scale attempts at open access from the Public Library of Science. And there hasn't been enough of these sorts of infrastructure-based programs to address this issue. I don't think that doing it institution by institution is actually going to be all that successful, and doesn't really address the community-based commons approach that I think will be more successful. So the idea of commons-based peer production actually has embraced open access journals as an example of the of these types of systems. So Wikipedia is often referred to as one of the most successful of these types of approaches, where you're looking at not at the open access, not only open access to the content, but also the infrastructure itself and that governance system that it has. There's also what is really quite an astonishingly successful and almost hard to comprehend, the free and open source software movement has really shown that even in the face of a context where there were proprietary and are companies producing commercial software and making proprietary systems available, that hundreds and thousands of people would dedicate their time to developing all sorts of software and making it available for free. It sort of defies comprehension. But what it also has proven is that actually, rather than the commons being some sort of tragedy, it's actually there can be many situations in which the masses coming together in order to create something and drawing on knowledge that's already available. So it actually couldn't occur unless that knowledge was made freely available in the first place, then generates whole new systems that actually wouldn't be possible in a proprietary system, because you simply wouldn't have access either to the knowledge or to the collaborations, beyond a single company. So it's really important to think about how actually this can be a beneficial model, and we don't have to be thinking about it always in sort of negative economic terms. So I haven't actually come across anything that really considers grey literature as common space peer production. So this is me sort of putting my colours to the mast, but I think that actually grey literature is a perfect example of common space peer production. Where when you think about the public policy context, there is hundreds of organisations who have chosen to make their content available in order to share that knowledge to create better decisions for the community and society at large. And it's often drawing on itself. It may also reference journal material as well, but it's very much the producers are also the consumers of that same sort of material. And similarly, things such as APO and open access repositories, archive, and all sorts of infrastructure systems that are out there, both institutional repositories, but also the many, many kind of discipline repositories are part of this kind of system. There's another movement at play around open science, or even more sort of democratic, is open and collaborative science. And some of the principles that come into this are knowledge as a public good, which we've already talked about, the right to research for social justice, and different ways of knowing and cognitive inclusion. So this is perhaps a more expansive version of open science, where it's trying to consider what sources of knowledge are going to be able to be included in any understanding of a scientific issue. So in practice, it's open access and open data and doing science openly and collaboratively. And in terms of policy, it's inclusion and innovation, funding, infrastructure, intellectual property and incentives. So this is another broader framework in which we can think about both open access to journals, but also grey literature, but also really sort of questioning who has the right to participate in science, and how is that participation going to be fostered. So there's a group led by Leslie Chan that came up with an open and collaborative science manifesto, which was launched this year actually in Cyprus. And this has been a product of collaboration over a few years with organisations both in the Global North and in the Global South, and that contribution of people from the Global South has really challenged quite a few of the assumptions that often come through from sort of Western ways of conceiving of knowledge and research. So the principles are that open and collaborative science enables a knowledge commons where every individual has means to decide how their knowledge is governed and managed. It recognises cognitive justice, the need for diverse understandings of knowledge. Right, so I think it was up to principle five. It Open science fosters equitable collaboration between scientists and social actors and cultivates co-creation and social innovation. It incentivizes inclusive infrastructures that empower people of all abilities to make and use accessible open source technologies, and it strives to use knowledge as a pathway to sustainable development, equipping every individual to improve the well-being of our society and planet. So these are quite, this is quite a different sort of view of the way in which knowledge is created and who gets to participate. So an example that was used from this was when community groups in Africa, in a particular area in Africa, were asked to participate in a scientific research. They were actually resisted because they felt that so much of their experience was really just of being exploited by researchers and not actually being able to participate in the research and actually having no access to the final product that of that research. I think Indigenous communities in Australia have often got similar sorts of feelings about academic research. So really coming to question who gets to participate, what that participation might look like, and how the structures and the knowledge structures can be changed. So this sort of leads me into another area which sort of coincides with the open science movement, which is the evidence-based policy movement. In some ways, this is evidence-based policy has had a tendency to actually reinforce very traditional notions of knowledge and knowledge production with evidence hierarchies and concepts of the randomized controlled trial as being the pinnacle of evidence, and that everything needs to actually be able to be filtered through some sort of randomized controlled trial before it can actually be accepted as some form of evidence. However, there are many counter movements to that idea, as it's really as Justin Parkhurst says, that actually is a political and approach which is privileges a very particular type of understanding and a particular type of evidence, and there are politics are around doing that. So he has come up with a nice sort of concepts around what counts as evidence, and trying to look at how in various contexts different types of evidence have different value. So if we think about what public policy is, it involves making decisions about how we should live and organise ourselves as individuals, institutions, societies, nations and the planet. Sorry, I'll just turn my phone off. Sorry about that. There are many participants across all sectors, and relevant information comes in multiple forms. So evidence addressing the key policy concerns at hand, as opposed to all the other evidence. Evidence that's applicable to the local context, as you may have evidence about an issue, but it's not about Australia. Evidence that's constructed in ways that are useful to address a policy concern. So he points out that, say, in various health interventions, it may be that there is academic evidence of a certain approach, but that there's been democratic surveys or even elections that have specifically aiming not to have that particular approach. So something like injecting rooms for drug users, that there may be the medical evidence for the efficacy of that, but there may be community evidence which says that actually the community has a democratic has exercised its democratic right to not have these by electing politicians who specifically on a platform to not implement those sorts of systems or services. So we can't just ignore legal or democratic or political evidence by privileging scientific evidence at all the time. It needs to be all put together, and the various types of evidence need to be weighted against one another, and he's got quite an interesting approach to doing that. There's in terms of thinking again about journal material and grey literature and so on, we can think about a sort of publishing taxonomy where there's the published literature, books and chapters, journal articles, magazines, media reports, conference proceedings. But the grey literature is actually very diverse, including reports, research reports, project reports, technical reports, discussion papers, briefings, guides, data sets, conference papers, submissions and evaluations, working papers, and so on. And then there's a huge range of sort of more ephemeral or internal material, including financial statements and tax returns and emails and newsletters and conversations. Often these are the subject of archival storage. So the one of the reasons to, in a way, to talk about grey literature, even though it's a kind of terrible term, is that the amount of material that comes under it is huge, and it's very difficult to sort of talk only about, say, government reports or discussion papers when actually there's such a range of material. The reason that it's also needs to be talked about in a specific way is that it is basically not produced by formal commercial or scholarly publishers, and therefore, because it's outside of those channels, it often misses out on any systematic management. And this is where the sort of the issue of the knowledge commons and the lack of infrastructure for being able to access grey literature comes into place. So some of the kinds of material that we think about with grey literature is reports on things such as Closing the Gap or Native Title, many of the practitioner kind of reports that we're all familiar with from OCLC or JISC or so on. There's major economic reports from multinational global organisations like APEC and Global Health, and of course even IPCC reports are themselves a type of grey literature, and have also had to rely on grey literature in many ways for many issues. So when we think about who participates in public policy, it's actually a huge range of organisations, political parties, government departments and agencies, universities and research centres, NGOs, lobby groups, think tanks, consultants, industry bodies, and the media. And this ecosystem is trying to use all sorts of research and analysis. Many of these organisations are producing research and analysis for policy and practice. They're commissioning reports and material, and they're disseminating and distributing access to many of these sorts of materials. I know some research that I've done a year or so ago, we looked at we surveyed 1,000 people on what research and information they use for policy and practice, and got responses from government, education, NGO and the commercial sector. And basically reports came out as the number one item used overall, and even more so amongst NGO communities. So So then many of the other things that are used, discussion papers, briefings and guides, data sets was actually really quite high, conference papers, books and ebooks. You can see the from this slide the benefit of having access to books and ebooks for the education sector. And also, if you look at submissions, how important submissions are to the NGO sector and so on. So it was a really great way of finding out just the diversity of materials that are actually used by people in, who are involved in policy research. The importance of journal articles is affirmed there, I think, but also a really huge range of other types of materials, and that different sorts of materials actually are more used to different sectors. We asked why great literature is important, and people said that policy development, advisory work and program design within government requires a good grasp of domain expertise, and this is greatly helped by great literature. It provides another part of the complete information picture. You wouldn't want to rely only on peer-reviewed material. A lot of women's health policy and preventative health literature is produced by small advocacy organisations and it's not indexed routinely. But grey literature is actually a big problem. It's difficult to know that it exists. It's hard to find, despite many benefits of Google. There's just so much that needs to be sifted and filtered through, and it's very time consuming. There are incredibly variable standards. It's about, because of the different standard in publishing standards, evaluation is difficult. This also makes it harder to collect and catalogue. Citation and link rot are huge problems if you don't take full text or even if you're using references, because things move around so much. There's actually, over the course of the last sort of 20 years, we're probably looking at a digital black hole of lost resources. There's a lack of long-term management and a lack of comprehensive databases for analysis and systematic review. And Janet Smith was a librarian at the Australian Institute of Criminology, and many thought that grey literature would be solved by the internet, and because it was always such a huge problem in print. But unfortunately, while some issues have been solved, many new ones have come up. So I think one of the issues with grey literature is it connects back into some of the things I was talking about earlier in terms of knowledge as public good, and it's part of our failure to recognise that something that is free and is freely available is actually still incredibly valuable. And but because of the sort of proprietary systems and the high evaluation of proprietary content, it's been subject to multiple failures in its management. So there's been a market failure because public goods are hard to commercialise and have been neglected by publishers and commercial databases. This is possibly a good thing in some ways, in that it hasn't all been locked up, but it also hasn't been subject to enough open source or commons-based solutions. There's been a government failure. There's just an incredible lack of interest in information management by government of their own resources or of publicly funded resources. There's been a civil society failure where there's a lack of resources and expertise to manage long-term access and repurposing of content. There's been an education failure, I think, by the university system to acknowledge that grey literature is a really important part of the research ecosystem. So the open access movement has failed to take account of grey literature, and even though it's really important, So I appreciate everybody listening to me bang on about grey literature in an open access forum. And there's been a systems failure where we have not adapted to copyright laws that keep up with the digital environment and have fair use. We have changed our practices in libraries and archives to take account of grey literature and digital materials. And we've not changed many of the incentives for academic reward systems to take into account the hard work that many academics do in producing grey literature. So my call to arms is that we need to work together to increase public investment and create long-term collaborative infrastructure to support open access to global policy evidence base. Now, I probably should wind up now. I was just... I'll really quickly run through a couple of things about APO. This was a quote which I won't read out, but I was really pleased to see that Clifford Lynch has identified grey literature as being one of the key areas that we need to address and that we really need to be broadening our understanding of the scholarly record and of the range of materials that that the information management community needs to take into account and provide new systems for. So if we're looking at developing open scholarly infrastructures, here's some principles that are quite useful where we need to be thinking about good governance, sustainability and insurance. And I think these are all really, really important. They're not easy though. As somebody who's been trying to run an open access database for over 10 years, finding that sustainable base of operation is incredibly difficult, and there's still not enough coming together and recognition of the issues and that these issues need to be addressed in a collaborative way rather than continually at an institutional level. So I'll just really quickly run through a few things about APO and try and finish in a couple of minutes so we can have some questions. So our vision was Australian Policy Online, but we changed this year to being Analysis and Policy Observatory so that we can more accurately show that we not only Australian but also cover a range of material from around the world. It's a global collaborative public knowledge base and information service for policy and practice. We are an information service and repository for researchers and provide interoperable metadata and long-term preservation and open access research infrastructure. It's grown from being a one-person operation to around 10 people, mainly part-time. We've got about 40,000 resources, 5,000 sources and 16,000 authors. So really in terms of that ecosystem that I was talking about before, we're really starting to be able to represent that at scale. It's open access, university-based, not-for-profit. We've won multiple research infrastructure grants from the ARC, ANZ and others, and we are also supported by a whole range of universities and organisations. Our audience comes from government, education, NGOs, and the media and so on. And here's a sense of the universities that are supporting us at the moment. And I would really emphasise that we are open to collaboration with every organisation and or any organisation around the world. In terms of, this is sort of a model in terms of sustainability, we are looking at constantly how we can find ways of maintaining and supporting the database. We have a whole range of content. So what distinguishes APO from many repositories is we also have events, jobs and courses, projects, websites, audio and video and so on. We do weekly newsletters, which are really what a lot of people rely upon to know what's out there. So current awareness in the policy space is a major issue that, you know, there's a big FOMO kind of fear that key policy document may have been released that gets missed. We have extensive metadata and classification systems, DOIs and so on. We can provide organisation and author profiles for centres and departments, and have a range of tools and so on. One of the big things that's been important for our growth is all sorts of collections on specific topics that organisations can sponsor and use to bring together resources. We can also do legacy collections for when centres close or organisations close conferences and so on. It's an example of a collection. You can embed the research on your own organisation's website. So this is an example from a digital inclusion project website. And we've been working with the CRC for Low Carbon Living to create a third-party website, which is now here, called builtbetter.org. So this is feeding APO content into a second site, completely separate, with its own look and feel. And we're looking at a range of new collections to work on from here. And we're working with the Internet Archive to digitise content from historical sources. It's, again, something that people might like to participate in with us. And we are interoperable with all sorts of systems. So that's it for me. I'm sorry, I went a bit over time. But that would be my call to any of you to either work with APO in terms of what we're doing, or I'm really interested in working with anybody who is interested in how we articulate that vision for the benefits of public access to knowledge.
Great, thank you very much, Amanda. That was a tremendous talk, really fascinating. I have to say that it shows the benefits of live programming, going on, continuing against all odds. It was tremendous, so thank you very much, and really fascinating. And actually, as you've also said, a really important, I think as somebody said, a really important wake-up call for quite a few of us about the needs around grey literature. So we've got a couple of questions in the chat, and so I'll kick off with those, and then I've got a few that I really wanted to get to you as well. So so first off, we've got a question from Michelle. So she's asked, does legal deposit legislation have a role in ensuring the government grey literature is collected and preserved? And how important do you see that as a driver, really?
It certainly helps. So the situation with government material is really it's really confusing. So legal deposit has been really important for print material. There's sort of different roles that the major players play. So obviously there's archives who have a responsibility to take, to collect material that government gives it. But that doesn't have to be accessible now. So that's sort of that's one operation that's there, but isn't necessarily all that useful for the public. Then there's the role of the National Library, which so far has been on web archiving, and so legal deposit has been really useful for that. In terms of more broadly, print-based legal deposits has been affected, but when I in some of the survey that I did ask organisations to what extent they provided copies of the material to the libraries for legal deposit, and it was very low. So there's not really that strong a sort of compulsion, I suppose, to do it.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. I think that's probably the case in other areas for you know, for other issues around open access. The legal side of it is something that's very variably implemented, certainly globally and even on a sort of local level. Okay, another question from Stephen Chang. So he said this has been a, thanks, and this has been a real wake-up call. He notes that he recommends people for academics that are doing systematic reviews and need to do search strategies. He recommends the Grey Matters tools for researchers. It's not one I'm familiar with. Is that one that is that you think is okay, or are there other key resources that we should be pointing people to?
Yeah, that's the New York Library of Medicine, I think it is. That is fantastic. The Canadians, for systematic reviews, the Canadians have done really fantastic work around grey literature. And there are some ways of sort of evaluating it. I think the problem is... just having that the large scale database. So I'm you know really interested in how do we move from what is generally the with grey literature with a systematic review, you do your systematic review of a research database, and then you have to start working on the grey literature, which becomes this very piecemeal sort of process and snowballing, etc. And if we could start to look at, well, as those systematic reviews are created and those grey literature material is collated, couldn't it get into a database that then would become something that could then feed on itself for the next review and then the next review, and you would start to be able to have a major systematic a major database of grey literature for systematic reviews. I don't know what Stephen thinks of that idea.
Yeah, I was wondering actually about, I mean, are you thinking about the role of the Campbell collaboration as well? Is that something that's been important in providing guidelines around systematic reviews in this area? I'm very familiar with the Cochrane collaboration for sort of medical research, but the Campbell collaboration seems to be able to help people pull things together to not, you know, not primary literature, which I think a lot of academics do struggle with on a sort of systematic basis.
Yes, no, I think that has been really important, and but I think they're struggling a little bit, and that is, you know, we could. They could probably do with more kind of knowledge commons support as well. It's quite tricky once you get outside of the health area around systematic reviews and grey literature and what is allowable as evidence and so on, which is why you sort of also need someone like Justin Parkhurst to be able to sort of counter that argument that it is all randomised controlled trials, because in social policy that's often either don't exist or shouldn't be the only kind of evidence that's taken into account.
Yeah, that's right for sure. Okay, I've got another question from Lookman Hayes. So he asks, you state at the front that the OA movement should join forces with others to create greater influence and clout. So which organisations or groups do you have in mind that that you think perhaps should be leading this that maybe aren't at the moment?
One problem, I suppose, is that there isn't really a strong enough movement in terms of grey literature itself. Peer-to-peer production people are quite interesting. That's Michelle Bauman, who's based in the UK. So they're doing some really interesting work. This year I was able to go to a conference in Athens on the social solidarity economy, and that was really fascinating, where it was a mixture between the knowledge commons but also the physical commons movements. So I guess that's another area. But yeah, the peer-to-peer production, Michelle Bauman is doing really interesting work there. There's a few different movements around the knowledge commons, I think. Probably Michelle Bauman's the main one.
Thanks, that's really interesting. And I actually think that, yeah, even just doing, having webinars like this are really helpful, because there is not a great deal of thinking across the different parts of, this various types of literature. We don't, as you said, the open access movement has spent far too little time thinking about areas outside of it. And I was actually really fascinated when you even had, this sort of ephemera on the end, this sort of the tax returns and meeting notes and such, like, all of which are really fascinating.
That's right. And, annual reports and things like that are often used a lot in business. So certain types of research get used in different areas. So sometimes there can be good collections of, say, annual reports, because that's been identified as being important for business analysis. Evaluations are notoriously difficult to find, really variable. I should also mention Force 11, which is actually a still an open access movement. And I do think is still there tends to be a fair bit of naivety around the nature of public policy and the nature of public debate and what actually gets used. So a lot of academic research is just not considered usable in public policy, and actually consultants are chosen over academic research all the time.
Okay, that's a little bit of a sobering kind of point to end on. In the interest of time, I'm going to finish here, although actually I think we've got I had some other questions, and I'm sure other folk have got things that they might want to follow up with you on. So I'm just going to thank you again for a fantastic presentation, particularly since you, I know, weren't well, and challenges of working at home, etc. It all came together really, really well, and I think we've had a lot of food for thought. I will do a slight plug for, we will have another of these, two more of these next in October and November. So please keep an eye out for those. We're always really happy to hear feedback on our webinars. But anyway, so just to finish by thanking Amanda again, and I hope you get better, get back to full strength. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. And thanks everybody for listening, and let's keep in touch.